Martha Serpas is the author of three collections of poetry, including The Dirty Side of the Storm and Cote Blanche. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Nation, The Southwest Review, and all the other literary journals that have rejected me in my career as a writer. She is a chaplain with a degree from the Yale Divinity School and teaches in the MFA program in creative writing at the University of Houston. Her latest book, which we're going to talk about today, is The Deaner. Martha Serpas, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you.
I just finished your book, The Deaner, and I just think it's a fantastic book. Before we get started on getting into some of the poems, tell us what deaner means. I had to look it up, and I'm glad I did because it's a really fascinating word.
And you were well served if you found it. A lot of dictionaries don't contain it. I had never heard it until I started doing some chaplaincy in a hospital. And it's the person who runs the morgue, not necessarily the pathologist, in most cases not, but it's the person who actually takes care of the bodies in the morgue. And it comes from the German for service. I did some chaplaincy work and continue to do so when I can at Tampa General. And I met the wonderful deaner there. And, of course, the term is used, you know, all over the hospital without note. But I thought it was fascinating. And the particular deaner there, his name is Raphael, believe it or not.
Palio, Raphael Palino, right?
Yes, the patron of healing, yes. He was very kind to me. And when I had breaks and time, he would let me come down to the morgue and he would teach me. He actually did a fair amount of organ harvesting because he was a medical doctor in the Dominican Republic. But when he came to the U.S., of course, he wasn't allowed to practice a pathology position. So he actually did more than most deaners do, and I was just fascinated by his work.
When I was reading the first poem, The Deaner, I couldn't help but think of when I was in Buenos Aires, I used to go visit this cemetery in Chacarita, and it was just this amazingly huge city of mausoleums with these high-rise buildings with multiple levels, and you can just go up and down. And there were these men who had a little booth, a little chair, or a stool, and then, you know, maybe a little table, and they would clean the graves, and they would freshen the, you know, make sure the plastic flowers looked fresh, but they worked entirely on tips. And I thought, man, what a patient job. And when I think about the job as the deaner, I'm thinking that even though it's an incredibly humble position, there's something deeply meaningful and spiritual about it.
Absolutely. When I think of Raphael, he really considers his work a calling to care for the dead. He often has salsa playing in the background while he's,
nice.
He has this deep reverence and care for what he's doing. That's very moving.
I would say that this book is not all about the deaner. I mean, it's not all about the dead. It's also about being a chaplain in a hospital, and some of the most moving poems, like Pearl Snap, for example, have to do with that position as a chaplain. That, you know, must be very difficult at times to have to deal with families in their great time of loss. But it also has to do with the erosion of the wetlands in Louisiana. And I'm wondering what the connection is between your commitment to the wetlands and your commitment to being a chaplain in a hospital.
For me, the very basic and difficult idea of things dying in order for other things to come into being is central to both of those experiences for me. It's very hard for me to look at the wetlands and know that they're already gone. It cannot be reversed. And at the same time, want to work to preserving them in this paradoxical way. And in the hospital, there are moments when someone or something is being lost, and we know that's necessary, and it's also very difficult. And so that interstitial space is where I saw those poems dealing with the same subject matter and emotion.
Part of your audio or your biographical makeup is your commitment to fighting the erosion of the wetlands in Louisiana. And you even participated in a documentary called Veins in the Gulf. But what you're telling me now kind of surprised me. I didn't know it was beyond hope for the wetlands. Is that true? It's there's not really much that can be done. What is it then that one can fight for about the wetlands?
Well, I'm speaking of paradox, really, because I'm thinking of this wonderful quotation from a rabbi named Rabbi Tarfon, and he says, "You are not required to complete the work, nor are you free to desist from it."
Oh, wow, that's beautiful.
We won't be able to save them, and we have to continue to try. And there's lots that can be done to save parts of the land, encourage rejuvenation of parts of the land. And as a whole, so much is lost that will have to come back in some other form, in the same way that that land was created by land in other places being eroded and the sediment washing down the river and forming the marshes where I grew up.
You know, I was going to ask you about the connection between landscape and body, and that kind of really answers it for me. The erosion of the landscape, you know, even if it's not ever going to return, you have to do something. And it's the same way we feel about the body. When somebody is dying, if somebody we love, we want to do anything we can to save that, even when we know there's no hope. And I guess as a chaplain, you're in a hospital, you're faced a lot of times with dealing with families knowing that there is no hope.
When I first got interested in this work, the biggest surprise to me was being told that the job of a chaplain isn't to comfort, isn't to help people feel better. The job of a chaplain is to help people be present to what's happening, in order to facilitate acceptance and healing in the future. With respect to the land, it doesn't help either to turn away and say it's lost or to look at it and deny what's happening. But that place of a full presence with its erosion as a means of beginning to accept and heal.
Yeah, that's quite a position to take, because I think a lot of times what we want to hear from chaplains is that, you know, if you believe things are going to get better, you know, let's lay hands on this person and let's heal this person. Mm-hmm. But to have them be in the now, to have them be in acceptance is really having them not think about the past and not think about the future and just to accept where they are. It must be very difficult. It sounds like poetry.
Well, I think it is. It is a blank page in a lot of ways. You come together with a family, or I come together with a family, and we really create something together. When I walk in the room, I don't know what's going to happen, and they don't know me. And we have a conversation or not, just time together, and that creates something akin to a poem that we both write. We both write.
If you're a chaplain, if you have some sort of faith, I'm not going to try to pigeonhole your faith or even ask you about it, really, but there probably is some sense that the body has a soul. And if the body has a soul, then the body is to the soul what the landscape is to what? Does the landscape have a soul as well?
Yes, it does. Although I'd be hard-pressed to describe that to you, but then again, I'd be hard-pressed to describe the part of a person's being that's the soul also. I think we just more commonly use the term.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I understand it any better. But I want to go back to something you said about the difficulty of being with people who are facing a death. We really are terribly uncomfortable with confusion, mm-hmm. I think, confusion is seen as a weakness. So that we often make bad decisions rather than make no decision.
Right.
Because at least we're decisive. You know, at least we're doing something. We have some moral agency. I have decided. And that's the hard part of those emergency, trauma, or end-of-life situations. We often have to sit with total uncertainty.
Right.
What you were alluding to, I think, the sense of, oh, I know God will save him. Or, oh, I know he's going to die, are both equally false. We don't know.
Mm.
But not knowing is the hardest part.
Right.
And having to sit with it.
When we're talking about the landscape having a soul or the body having a soul, I think that soul is a word that it's a way for us to understand with a word the meaning of a person to us, the past, what they mean to us emotionally, what they mean to us, you know, on all levels, the memories we have, the synapses that light up in our brain every time we think of them, or when we encounter an image that reminds us of them. And in a sense, that's what a landscape is. They're both measures of time, or at least how we think about time. You have this one poem called Paradis, and you have this line that says, "The land's so flat you could see yesterday." It's almost as if what they both mean to us is mortality, of, you know, our individual mortality when it comes to a body, and our human mortality, our humanness, I guess, when it comes to the landscape. Also, the word erosion itself speaks of time. Let's talk about the frame of the book. The section opens with the poem, The Diener, and it closes with a chaplet for Lana. And mm-hmm. I had to look up what chaplet meant, too. And it's either a wreath or garland for the head or a string of beads. But it begins with the dead and it ends with the dead. Was that a conscious frame on your part, or a conscious, you know, presentation of the book, you know, framed between these two bodies?
I set them off so that the diener would serve as an invocation and a chaplet for Lana would serve as a coda. And I did see, after having the sense that they needed to serve in those two roles, I did see that there was a emphasis on the material body in the diener, and an emphasis on what we might call the soul in a chaplet for Lana. And I was happy with that when it shaped up that way.
When you wrote the book, did you know it was going to have particular themes, or were you just writing poetry and then you put the book together and saw the themes and organized it according to that?
The latter. And that's been my experience. At the end of my first book, I didn't see at all that the poems were leading toward this meditation on land loss. And then The Dirty Side of the Storm, which is my second book, is, you know, clearly about that, but it's sort of like I didn't see it coming. Mm-hmm. And I did chaplaincy work for about 5 years before I wrote a single poem that had anything to do with it. And so I didn't see how the two were going to intertwine until I was really putting the diener together.
I interview a lot of poets, and that's how most of them do. I think sometimes when you try to be theme forward at the beginning of the book, it may, number one, take a heck of a long time to do, or take very little time to do and not be very good.
I find it very difficult to have any sort of framework in mind and write toward that.
You teach in an MFA program at the University of Houston, which is known as one of the, quite frankly, best MFA programs in the country. Your poems seem to have incredible, well, first of all, the language is amazing, and the images, you know, I mean, you can really enter into these poems and linger there and be in the moment. But also the poems, you know, whether you're conscious of it during the writing time or not, because I think a lot of times when we write, we're in some sort of zone, prayer-like zone, where we're not really thinking of what our meaning is. But the poems themselves speak of, these are poems with a purpose. And I'm wondering, as a professor in the MFA program, where you, I assume, teach poetry, do you find that programs oftentimes emphasize craft and production over purpose? Why we write poetry is perhaps, you know, not as important as, you know, the focusing on craft?
Yes, I think that's true. Perhaps the way I'd say it is that purpose is sort of assumed to be understood, right? Mm-hmm. These writers get together to work on their craft, we say, not so much on their practice. It's assumed that there's a passion, a commitment, a vision that's already there. We're working on craft. And I do think that sometimes that's overweighted. At Houston, I teach a class that's now called Eco Poetics on the Gulf. It used to go by a nickname, the Shrimp Boat Project, and it's a long story, but it had to do with two artists who started this project of actually working on a shrimp boat, learning to trawl, and letting that really be their artwork. And so part of this class that I teach is about reading shore lyrics, the very American, I stand on the shore and contemplate the universe, you know, the Whitman, the Crane, right, the Bishop, and reading Gulf Coast poets, and also spending a lot of time down in the marshes in Galveston, say about 25% of our class time, so that those students come to Houston, come to the Gulf area, and actually get a sense of where they are, not mm-hmm. just a few city blocks where they live and the campus of UH. And that groundedness, I think, helps students rethink what it is they want to do with their poetry, if that makes sense.
Right. No, no, absolutely. It sounds like a great class. Do you ever teach just a straight-up workshop?
Oh, yes. And I also teach a class that's in which the students read what I would call wisdom literature, or to steal a title from Wallace Stevens, you probably wouldn't like this use of it, How to Live, What to Write. And so we read pieces of everything from the Tao in Genesis to Emerson to Simone Weil. And it's really a class about encountering the text and what it means for their writing lives, rather than sort of dissecting the text for craft.
I'm talking to Martha Serpas, whose new book, The Diener, is, well, it's brand new. I got an advance uncorrected proof. And it's a fantastic book. Some of the poems have appeared in The New Yorker. You're a regular contributor to The New Yorker, which is like the hardest magazine ever to get into if you're a poet. The Birmingham Review, so many different places. It's a fantastic book. But I can't help, when I'm reading it, to think about you got a master's degree from the Yale School of Divinity, and the poems are quite frankly deeply spiritual, and I can't help but think of the link between spirituality and writing poetry. And just on the level of when you go to divinity school, I imagine it's incredibly challenging scholar-wise, that you have to do a lot of exegesis, you have to do a lot of reading, you have to do a lot of writing. And I think just that experience with exegesis itself is incredibly linked to poetry. In fact, I think if you look at if you did a survey of some of the best poets writing today, probably 80% of them have incredibly strong spiritual backgrounds. Either their fathers or mothers were pastors or something like that. Do you find that your experience as a chaplain, your experience with exegesis, causes you to think about the text in a different way?
Well, earlier you used the term prayer-like with respect to writing. And that's certainly my experience of it. The only time that I feel completely grounded and giving full attention to something is when I'm writing. And that's an understanding of prayer, I
mm-hmm.
think.
Right.
With respect to text, reading scripture or reading theological text is a very different experience than reading text to dissect craft and technique.
Mm-hmm.
Although that is a little unfair, because of course poems that we are studying can change our lives in the same way that we can read scripture and theological text and learn a lot about rhetoric and technique and craft as well. But I think you're right that the reverence and close attention that's paid to studying religious texts is influential on how one approaches poetry later.
I love the book, and I'm hoping that you might be able to read one of the poems for us.
Sure, I'd love to. Which one would you like me to read?
Well, I like so many of them. I like The Diener. I like a lot of them. But you know what I think would be really great for the radio would be Pearl Snap. And I had to look up what pearl snap meant. It's those pearl buttons that you click together on, like, Western-style T-shirts, like cowboy
That's
T-shirts.
Right. Yes. Pearl snap. Education is the answer to our social woes. And not the get-a-good-job after high school, but the deep-plotting kind, the making-of-many-books kind, get everybody together to debate the big questions kind. When I'm in Walmart and some kid dangling by the wrist is screaming, his mom in shorts that slice her thigh, saying something deep to him through her teeth, her long hair smelling like she has more than one job, I know it's not her fault. She's carrying a combination wallet, cigarette case with a pocket for the lighter. Her husband, well, the father of her last two, her divorce isn't final from her ex, is waiting in the truck, a Ford. Her dad had a problem with that, and so they went duck hunting and worked it all out. Her man didn't graduate, even though his junior high let the boys go when trawling season began, but going back got harder. She took typing and bookkeeping and even AP math. She says she manages a convenience store where you learn how to just take on the present. Right now, she just needs to find that pearl snap for her oldest. And why is it suddenly so dang hard to find a boy's 12 pearl snap? There are a few like her in every cow town. When the copter brings a woman's child, a certain woman of that kind, from the parish or the county to the city, and we all stand around the trauma bay watching environmental services sweep up the gauze wrap and cut clothes, and that woman from the boonies is still not here, driving her husband's truck as hard and steady as she can, I'll meet her in family consult or stand her in the shiny hallway. She'll go anywhere. And depending on what the test tube intern has to say, she'll either squat, lay her forearm against her stomach, and loose that first whale groan that defies conceit. Or she'll tutor me in the language of living in good faith, of staring down what I have to say and opening her mind to it, taking it in like a nursling and knowing it whole until the two can sleep side by side. We tell her, it's going to be a long road. And she says, as long as there's a road, I'm on it.
That was Martha Serpas reading the poem Pearl Snap from her new book, The Deaner. Martha, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire. I wish you the best of luck with this book.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.